Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Did you know that some of our break music comes from independent musicians? Maybe you'll be one of them. Find more information at thetakeaway.org/music.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
This land was made for you and me.
In the squares of the city.
In the squares of the city.
By the shadow of the steeple.
You know, you really have to wonder what is going on in President Obama's mind today as he prepares for his State of the Union speech tonight. The death of Pete Seeger at age 94, a man who played at Barack Obama's inaugural concert on the Lincoln Memorial. You can hear it right there. He's something of a conscience of American progressivism. Will Seeger's legacy motivate Barack Obama to change a word of his speech? Is he scratching out words right now? Maybe the influence has already been felt. An estimated 40 to 50 million people will tune in to hear tonight's address. It's an opportunity for any president in the State of the Union. Those aren't Super Bowl numbers, I'll grant you, and we'll speak about that later this hour. But first, you've been telling us what you want to hear from President Obama this evening and what should be on the president's to-do list for 2014. From Charlotte, North Carolina, jobs and economic stabilization, equitable redistribution of wealth, Anchorage, Alaska, amend the Affordable Care Act to really be affordable. Lots of you suggested immigration reform. We got lots of calls and texts about fixing our prisons.
Hey, this is Ketch in New York. I think that an important priority would be for President Obama to consider prison reform and federal protection from discrimination for people based on gender and gender expression.
We got a fairly strong sense of your priorities in all of your responses, and that's what we want to discuss now. We'll hear more about the income gap a little later this hour. But we begin with the state of Obamacare, immigration reform, and criminal justice. Three big priorities with you out there. Joining us is Mary Agnes Carey, reporter for Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, welcome.
Thank you.
Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, welcome.
Thank you.
And Stephen Handelman here in the studio with me, executive editor of The Crime Report. Hey, Steve.
Thank you. Hello.
So for the three of you, these are issues that our listeners really think are very, very important for the president to address tonight. But we wanted to discuss what could conceivably be done, either in a radical way or in a concrete, practical way to address any of these issues. Mary Agnes Carey, some folks were calling for serious amendments to Obamacare. Some were saying, perhaps cynically, a repeal Obamacare, apologize for Obamacare. What do you think can happen over the next 12 months?
Well, I think tonight the president has to get out there and talk about his health law and really sell it to the American public. There's been lots of enrollment problems. This is why people are talking about repeal and amendments and so on. And so if he makes the case to the American public for his health law, saying, yes, we've had problems with the website, but we've got to move forward, that could really change the course of this law over the next 12 months. It could mean more people enroll in it. It could also mean people who currently have insurance look at some of the new benefits that they have and they find the law beneficial to them.
So, Fernando, the president seems to believe that there is a possibility for progress on immigration. He actually said as much when I met with him along with some other folks at the White House last week. He seems to think that there's the possibility of progress, even given this Congress. What do you think?
There is a renewed sense of a momentum, John. The president will probably talk about immigration, the need for immigration reform, the economic benefits for the country, but he will probably not be tough on Republicans on this time, because there's this possibility that there is a momentum growing for action within the next few months. Speaker Boehner is supposed to come out with a set of principles which will include a way of legalizing millions of undocumented immigrants, and even former vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan said so last week that they will try to tackle this issue before the end of the summer. So there is some room for progress on this issue right now.
That's Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Stephen Handelman here with me in New York, executive editor of The Crime Report. I was kind of surprised that our listeners were so focused on prison reform, on criminal justice. I think you've had an initiative from the Justice Department on the Rockefeller drug laws and mandatory minimum sentences. Do you think the president will address this and it has a real national resonance?
Well, if the president addresses prison reform, and I'm not sure he will, he'll be really knocking on an open door. This is one area where there's a huge amount of bipartisan consensus, and I'm not surprised that a lot of viewers, a lot of listeners are really interested in it, because we're at a point in the in our criminal justice system where people understand the need for really major, major change. We have 2 million people in prison. Crime rates are going down. And there are a lot of bold and innovative experiments out there saying, you know, we don't have to spend that much money. We can stop constructing so many prisons. And we can begin to work with the people who are in prison now and make sure when they come out, they don't get back in again. And the federal government has been leading on this. Much of the action has to be in the states, however.
Talking with Stephen Handelman, executive editor of The Crime Report. Also with us is Mary Agnes Carey, reporter for Kaiser Health News, and Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. You know, Mary Agnes and Fernando, I think of you as sort of two different snapshots of the same policy narrative. Obamacare was a compromised attempt to reform health care. And I think the president is living the legacy of a lot of the imperfections there. In immigration, Fernando, it's conceivable that the Congress will do the exact same thing, pass something that really makes no one happy, and we'll be talking about immigration in the same way that we're talking about Obamacare in 12 months. Mary Agnes, what advice would you have, or some sort of watchword would you have for Fernando as immigration makes its way through the legislative process?
It's really important to see if there's any way that Republicans and Democrats can come together, because one thing we've seen with the health law is it was passed with completely Democratic votes, and they used different procedural moves and so on to get it passed. But the problem, without bipartisan support, implementation is really hard.
Looking at Obamacare over the next 12 months, Mary Agnes, the lack of Republican buy-in, what are the implications? What's the headwind for the president that's really a legacy of that Democrats-only voting strategy years ago?
Well, basically it means if you need additional funding, which the president has asked before in past budgets, you're not going to get it because Republicans aren't going to help you. If there's any problems with your website and you need additional scrutiny, it's all on you, being the president and the Democrats, that you've had those problems. If premiums increase more than they expected, if people find that this benefit is unaffordable to them, Democrats and the president have absolutely no support with the Republican Party as it moves forward. So whether it succeeds or fails, it's really all on the Democrats.
So, Fernando, the buy-in question on both sides of the aisle, how effective do you think that's going to be? How much does the president have to do to really address that? You sort of alluded to it a moment ago. And what's the chance that something could be enacted that makes no one happy?
Well, I totally agree with Mary Agnes here. First of all, the window for passing this seems to be very narrow. Everybody talks about that this issue has been consistently died every time we get to an election year. And again, we're in an election year, so people are talking maybe the next 4 months. But there is bipartisan support for immigration reform. The question will be, what are the requirements for legalization? Will citizenship be included or dropped? And I think that is the key for support on both sides of the aisle.
Stephen Handelman, let's end on the notion of criminal justice and prison reform. You know, in the 1970s, Richard Nixon began the tough-on-crime political strategy that carried us through the 80s and well into the 90s. So we remember the Willie Horton crime issue that changed the course of presidential history. And I'm just wondering if a call for justice can be equally powerful a national sort of message on prison reform as being tough on crime was in the 80s and 90s.
It would be nice to think so. This is an issue that has legs right now. I mean, there are both economic and moral arguments for changing and really taking a new look at our justice system. The one problem is that it's still a very fragile consensus. The first time somebody walks out of prison and commits a murder or commits a major offense, the headlines immediately go nuts over it. And then you have legislators, particularly in the states, saying, we've got to be tough on crime, because their voters are suddenly saying, you know, you can't let this happen.
But the one thing we've learned, though, is that the toughness in sentencing and the toughness in building more prisons is not sustainable and accomplishes nothing.
We know that, and those are rational arguments, but irrationality too often creeps in when we talk about criminal justice.
Well, our listeners love a challenge, and they may be out ahead on the edge of this one, even if the president doesn't address it in his State of the Union speech. Stephen Handelman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stephen is the executive editor of The Crime Report. Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks to Mary Agnes Carey, reporter for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thank you.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine?
There he is, a tall, serious-looking man with an inner smile. Pete Seeger taught a lot of people a lot of things.
I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
My generation, he taught you to mistrust what schools and the media and government say about what they are really doing. There's no silencing of Pete Seeger. His death at age 94 will simply remind us that the movements he set in motion go on, cannot be stopped.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing, where have all the flowers gone?
His voice and lyrics inseparable from the 20th century's history of protest, the anti-war movement. He wrote this song for that. It immediately became an anthem.
The girls have picked them, everyone.
The workers' rights movement.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions.
Civil rights.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
The environment.
And when drill, baby, drill. Turns to spill, baby, spill. God's counting on me. God's counting on you.
Pete Seeger has been there at the center of it all. Commenting on Twitter, British singer Billy Bragg tweeted, Pete Seeger towered over the folk scene like a mighty redwood for 75 years. His songs will be sung wherever people struggle for their rights. We shall overcome. Reverend Jesse Jackson, we remember today change agent Pete Seeger. Chuck D., from Public Enemy, a simple amen, R.I.P. Seeger.
To everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven.
This song is a setting from the Bible's Book of Ecclesiastes, a fusion of protest, pacifism, and religious passion. Seeger was a man who saw no categories and never saw a reason to keep quiet about the injustice he saw everywhere around him.
Now we've got more money in the bank, maybe.
That's new.
But you know, this old world still's got problems.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that you can solve so many problems yourself, but other problems takes the whole doggone world. You know, no matter how much money you got, those bombs can still fall down in your head.
That's right.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside.
Optimistic, performing, and smiling to the end, you always had the sense that Pete Seeger understood that he had his adversaries cold. Something about his activism, pacifism, and taste for mischief was a one-of-a-kind combination. There's no such thing as a wrong note, he once said, as long as you were singing it. He asked once in song, where have all the flowers gone? Now we know. Hey, leave some behind for us, won't you, Pete Seeger? Will the president tonight go beyond his raising of the federal minimum wage for workers employed by a federal contractor? The president will use his executive order powers to raise the wage of such workers to a minimum of $10.10. A full increase of the federal minimum wage would require approval of Congress. So how much can the president do alone to address an issue he has raised repeatedly since his reelection? Income inequality and the plight of the poor and unemployed who, despite the recovery, continue to slip farther and farther behind.
Hi, my name is Diane, and I'm calling from the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania. I believe President Obama's very first priority should be the immediate extension of the emergency unemployment compensation benefits. Over 1.3 million people in the United States received the EUC benefits until December 28, 2013, when the assistance was abruptly ended. Since then, many, if not most of us, have been suffering a terrifying freefall into poverty, with the possibility of an EUC extension our only hope to help us regain a semblance of stability for our children and families.
A lot of you spoke about unemployment benefits and the raising of the minimum wage, but restoring unemployment benefits can do little more than act as a safety net for the economically vulnerable. Income inequality, the gap between the rich and poor, is a much larger question. We intuitively feel as though the gap is widening. The notion of two Americas seems plausible wherever you go. But what do the numbers say? By one measure, U.S. income inequality is the highest it's been since 1928, right before the Depression. In 2012, the highest earning 20% of U.S. families, that's just considering income alone, earned 59.1% of all income. And the richest 20% of U.S. families own 88.9% of all wealth. Perhaps that's the most telling figure of all. Compared to the rest of the world, even after taking into account government income transfer programs, the U.S. has the second highest level of inequality, second to the nation of Chile. Scott Winship is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Scott, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.
What do you think these numbers tell us? They're kind of dizzying. They seem to sort of hit us in the gut a little bit. But from your perspective, what do they tell us?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that inequality has increased in the United States, although not necessarily all that much since 1989, it turns out. And it's certainly the case that we have more inequality than other countries do. But when I look at the research, it looks to me like, at least since the 1980s, the share of income received by the top 1% has risen, has certainly risen, but less than we think oftentimes.
Well, let's talk about sustainability. Are we looking at a situation that has, become sustainable and that it's going to go on like this? Or if we look down south to the nation of Brazil, where prosperity has produced all kinds of political turmoil precisely because of the perception of an income gap growing. Do you see any sort of breaking point here?
I don't. So if you look to the 1990s, when inequality was high and rising, no one cared all that much about inequality levels at the time. Certainly, you didn't have Occupy Wall Street or anything like that. The reason that people didn't care so much about it then was that in the 1990s, we had robust economic growth. The incomes of the poor and the middle class rose by a fair amount during the 1990s as well. So I think that what you're seeing is we're still in the midst of a fragile recovery. But I do think as the economy recovers and the middle class and incomes at the bottom start to rise again, you'll see this being a less salient issue.
I'm wondering if the growth levels of the 90s were something of a narcotic in the sense that everyone had the sense that their lot was improving. But as you flatten out the growth numbers, particularly during this recession, there's much more of a perception that some people are insulated from the effects of the business cycle and other people are not. And I'm wondering if that sort of ends this sense of everything's okay that we saw in the 90s.
Well, I think if you distinguish between the long term and the short term, in the long term, since, say, 1979, income growth has just been more robust for the middle class and for the poor than people realize. The Congressional Budget Office has figures that they put out every year that show that since 1979, incomes have risen by 40 to 50% among both the middle class and the poor, which is certainly contrary to people's intuition. In the short term, what you actually see since 2007, right before the recession hit, is that incomes for the middle and the bottom have not risen, but they actually didn't fall either. And that was because the safety net played exactly the role that we would hope that it would. It kept incomes from falling. So again, I think as the economy turns around, I think we're going to start to see less of a need for safety net programs like food stamps, like unemployment insurance. And I think we are going to see the benefits of growth redound to the middle class and poor.
Well, then let's focus on what you seem to have alluded to there, the intuition gap, in the sense that the numbers tell one story and that people's sense of economic justice is something else. How much of a sense among Americans, particularly in the middle class, that economic justice doesn't exist for them, that there aren't options for them? How much of that is politically significant, and does someone like the President of the United States need to address, even if the economic numbers say, hey, look, it's not so bad?
I think you're pointing to a dynamic for politics, and even Republican legislators, I think, are reticent to say, hey, actually, it's been a lot better than you all think. That said, you know, I look at some of the public opinion polls, and what I see is that a lot of anxiety about these sorts of economic issues really do fluctuate with the state of the economy. And until the recession hit, people were pretty optimistic. So I really do think that we're going to see the dynamic shift a lot. And this time next year, things will actually look quite a bit different.
Scott Winship is the Walter B. Wriston Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Scott, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.
The virtual digital currency Bitcoin may be the future of money to some, but has attracted some good old-fashioned money laundering charges to Robert Faiella and Charlie Schrem, two men who run the online exchange BitInstant. The charges were announced yesterday by the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office. The New York Department of Financial Services is in the middle of a process of trying to figure out where Bitcoin fits into the financial world. A two-day hearing begins today. Charlie Herman, WNYC Economics editor, joins us now. Welcome, Charlie.
Hello.
So do money laundering charges say, hey, Bitcoin is just good old-fashioned money, or does it say it's a platform for some sort of nefarious activities?
Well, it has this bad reputation right now that every time we hear about Bitcoin, maybe in the mainstream media or people who aren't paying maybe a lot of attention to Bitcoin, when they do hear it, it's often connected to things like illegal gains or trading drugs or, you know, other things like this or pornography. So it is this problem that it has right now that is getting a bad reputation. But I would also argue that they're trying to push past this, those sorts of headlines are shifting more to seeing more of these stories about the Department of Financial Services here in New York trying to figure out what to do about Bitcoin, because you're hearing these stories of there's an ATM in Vancouver where you can actually transfer money into Bitcoins, or you can use Bitcoins to get money out of. There's businesses here in New York City and other parts of the country that are beginning to accept Bitcoin. So I think it's beginning to transition a little bit away from this bad reputation that it has and more into one where people maybe actually have to start asking, should I care about this? I mean, do you care about electronic currency?
Well, is Bitcoin a duck? Does it walk like a duck? In other words, is it a currency? Is it more of a credit instrument? Is it more like a derivative? What is it?
You know, I think it's what you believe it to be. And I mean, you could take this to what is money? What is the $20 bill, this green piece of paper that you have in your pocket? A lot of it is the faith and belief in what is behind it. And it's a little bit of what's going on with Bitcoin, where it doesn't really have an intrinsic value. It's the value that people put into it. And what people are seeing more and more is that it actually is something that can be used as a medium of exchange, that I can take my dollars and convert them into Bitcoins that I think it has a value and transfer that to you, and then you can take those Bitcoins and transfer them back into dollars. And this becomes really interesting for people maybe who want to use Western Union, for example, and send money back home to a foreign country. This may be a more efficient way to do it without as many fees. You don't necessarily have to have a bank account. There may be ways that Bitcoin can actually be used by average people and not those obsessed with the internet.
Is there a convergence happening here? I mean, so much of the financial world is transacted online, but that's not Bitcoin. That's traditional currency transacted online. Bitcoin is both online and a virtual currency.
Yeah, I think we are seeing a little bit of this, and I think that's the most interesting thing about Bitcoin is that the financial industry is trying to figure out, do they want to participate in this? I think right now the answer would be no, especially when every time there's a story about it, it's something negative. It's about money laundering issues or illegal drugs.
Well, hey, I can just say to them, Madoff, hello?
Well,
it's like,
you know, if they
Bitcoin didn't invent that.
If they're having problems enough already, they may want to stay away from a currency connected to that. That said, there are some really interesting technical achievements in Bitcoin in terms of the way that electronically it works. So they may be interested in finding ways to co-opt it, to use it where it makes sense, and then other places try and disregard it. But, you know,
finally, do you think what the New York Department of Financial Services does will be the template for regulations, federal or global?
Well, you know, New York is such at the center of money transactions and Wall Street. And so I think if they come up with particular rules that they want to issue that could either help Bitcoin become more mainstream or stifle it, I think that what they set here in New York State will end up having, you know, repercussions nationwide, because what they set here, most of the financial institutions being based here will want to follow that, and that'll sort of follow on the rest of the country.
Bitcoins, I guess the question is, could you put them in a mattress? Virtual.
You could take your laptop, your hard drive, and stick it in the mattress. Maybe that would save your Bitcoin.
Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC. Thanks so much, Charlie.
You bet.
One one more financial story, but nothing virtual about it. What is happening in the emerging markets over the past week? Investors seem to have lost faith in the hot economies of Argentina, Turkey, South Africa, Russia, all on the decline. Huge moves in some of their currencies, with ripples being felt on Wall Street. Some are calling it an emerging markets crisis. Financial and political turmoil simultaneously in developing economies. Gillian Tett is assistant editor and columnist at the Financial Times. You predicted that this would happen in the early months of 2014, Gillian?
Well, I certainly wrote a column last autumn saying that there were some very big vulnerabilities in the emerging markets. And the thing to understand about the emerging markets is they have been hot, hot, hot as far as Western investors are concerned for the last few years, because people looked at the growth rates in America and Europe and said, you know what, places like Brazil and China look so much more exciting. What's happening right now is they're going from hero to zero, and suddenly investors are getting cold feet and starting to panic about some of the fundamental problems in the emerging markets.
There are fundamental differences between Brazil and China. Let's take one at a time. Brazil, it seems to me, has underlying political sort of deliverables problems that they really can't satisfy their population fast enough, even with the growth rates that are going on. Are the markets really beginning to see that?
Absolutely. And one of the things about Brazil, which is a problem of other emerging market countries like South Africa and India too, is that if you dial back a decade or two ago, those countries really did make a very big reform effort. They put a lot of changes into their economy, they didn't borrow too much, and they were pretty virtuous. The problem is, though, that like anyone who's ever been on a diet and thought, wow, I've done so well, I can let it easy for a while, they've kind of been backsliding for the last couple of years. And a lot of the growth that people were excited about until quite recently was because of the reform efforts they'd made about 10 years ago. And they've kind of taken their foot off the pedal as far as that reform's concerned. And so reality is catching up, unfortunately.
Quick question about Argentina. A 15% downward move in the currency last week. Who loses there aside from consumers?
Well, a lot of Argentinians, obviously, and a lot of Argentinian institutions. I mean, it's not been pretty at all. And Argentina is the most extreme example. But some way to understand what's going on right now is to think back to the financial crisis with Lehman Brothers. Essentially, what you had there was lots of concerns in the market. People knew that things were going wrong, but it took one institution to actually have a big shock for ripples to go across the entire system. That's what you're seeing right now.
China seems to have some of the same problems as Brazil, but there's an added complexity in China in that China's growth is really dependent upon its ability to market products to the rest of the world. And if demand begins to slack off in Europe and the United States, China suffers, and so it's sort of a feedback loop.
Well, there are two big issues with China right now. Firstly, as you say, it's been a very export-driven economy until recently, which means that when demand does slow down in a country like America, that hurts Chinese factories. The Chinese authorities are trying to rebalance because they know that's not sustainable. So they're trying to get Chinese consumers to spend more, but that's taking a time to readjust. And there are some big, big structural dislocations there. The second big problem, though, which will be familiar to anyone listening to this program in America, is a credit bubble. China's had a massive credit bubble. Its banks are stuffed full of potential bad loans. And just like America a few years ago, it's having to deal with that problem.
Is Turkey the hidden wild card here in that it may be the most unstable of all, and that if it goes in a serious way, it could have very, very unpredictable implications around the world?
Well, Turkey in many ways is a poster child for a country which did some great reforms a few years ago but has slowed down and is plagued by the so-called twin deficit problem, a current account deficit and capital deficit. It's certainly in the process of trying to address some of those issues belatedly. The central bank is talking about raising interest rates. The big problem, though, is that Turkey not only has big economic problems, of course it's got political problems too. And the question of what the Islamic groups are going to do or not do inside Turkey give an added frisson, if you like, to the whole debate.
And it's smack dab in the middle of a region that includes Saudi Arabia, the Syrian civil war, and unraveling Lebanon right now. And so wither the economy of Turkey, wither the political stability of an entire region. Gillian Tett, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Talking about the emerging markets crisis, fluctuations that we've seen very disturbingly over the past week in some emerging markets. Gillian Tett is assistant managing editor and columnist at the Financial Times. What a complicated, wonderful, intentional life. Whether you agreed with him or not, Pete Seeger did what he said he would do, and he walked the walk of principle you could hear in every note of his distinctive singing voice.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera, Guantanamera.
As a protester, he was arrested, sentenced to prison, got reversed on appeal. He was a writer of songs, pop music legend, something he apparently cared very little about. If Pete Seeger was only remembered for his little book on how to play the five-string banjo, inventing and popularizing all sorts of playing techniques, including his Bum Diddy style, Hammering On, and others, if only for this, he would be immortal. But he saved his big hammer for the big fights he took on in his long life.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land.
Pete Seeger will be remembered in the Northeast for his efforts to clean up his own backyard, the Hudson River. He lived in the town of Beacon. He outfitted a sailing ship, the Clearwater, that still sails. The seemingly quixotic ship confronted industrial polluters, and the annual Clearwater Revival helped support litigation and enforcement that eventually got General Electric to begin dredging PCBs from the Hudson. 94 long years, and for many of them, longtime radio host and public radio personality and advocate, Alan Chartok, president and CEO for WAMC Northeast Public Radio, was Pete Seeger's friend and on-air companion for millions of public radio listeners. Alan Chartok, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thank you so much, friend and neighbor.
Yes, indeed. And you've lost one of your listeners.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I love Pete. I mean, I loved him. When I was 14 years old, I was on the porch of the Bucks Rock work camp, John, and I was, all of a sudden I saw this crowd of people who were around this guy, and I went up and I started listening. I was gone. From that time on, I mean, I must have listened to one Pete thing a day. And here I am at 72 for all of those years. So this is really quite a wallop. Of course, Pete has always been a giving person. He lived in two rooms, two small rooms. And he once came to visit us and stayed at our house with a troupe that were playing in the Mahewee Theater in Great Barrington. And he stayed at our place, and he stayed in our third floor little suite, which is now the Pete Seeger suite, filled with Pete Seeger stuff, and pictures of Pete at every age, including a picture which I sort of stole from Harold Leventhal, his legendary manager, who got him back in the game.
Sure.
After he had been blacklisted and all. And he had a picture on the wall of all the Weavers, the beginning Weavers, and then all the people who tried to take Pete's place over the years and did so, you know, in various degrees of success. But when I took a picture of the picture and I brought it home, it was all convoluted. So I gave it to a wonderful man who lived in our town, who was a guy named Jaffe at Jaffe, and who had all kinds of photographic equipment. And one day he showed up at the house, and there it was in great splendor, all of the Weavers. And I have that photo up on the wall, and it means so much to all of us, because at 14, I heard him for the first time, and then for the rest of my life, every day there was at least one Pete Seeger infusion. Mm. And so that's how passionate I am about him. But I have to say, John, so is everybody else.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
I don't own Pete Seeger. No one owns Pete Seeger. Everybody met him. Everybody had a story. He was on a train, and he took out his banjo, and he played with me, says the one guy. Or I remember him when he came to my school, to the Ethical Culture, or the Little Red Schoolhouse. Or I remember when he came here and there. I swear, I don't think there's anybody in the world who hasn't had an encounter with the guy at some point.
Yeah, including our president. We're talking with Alan Chartok, president and CEO for WAMC Northeast Public Radio, the listener home of Pete Seeger there in Beacon, New York, part of your listening area. Alan,
it
you
is.
Own that How to Play the Five-String Banjo book, if I'm not mistaken, right?
No, I learned how to play the five-string banjo from his book.
From his book,
right.
Exactly.
Everybody did. He said it was his best-selling piece of writing. And it had such incredible stuff in it. Not only was there bum-diddy, 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 which is the basic strum, but he also told you how to take a regular banjo and make it into a long-neck banjo with an extra 3 frets at the bottom. He told you how to saw it off and where to do it, and it was an extraordinary effort. You know, Pete is always going to be known as a great man. His wonderful wife, Toshi, who just passed, and we were there for the memorial service at Ethical Culture in New York.
Just short of their 70th anniversary.
Yeah. And he always said she was the smart one in the family. But they were both pretty smart. But she did run things, including that Clearwater Festival, and so much more.
Alan, let me just ask you one question, because you focus on so many of these things in your sort of passionate recounting here. Pete Seeger was a mentor in so many ways, whether you learned to play the banjo from him, learned to sing a song from him, or learned how to be an activist from him.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, he had more guts than anybody I know. You know, on a day like today, he would be out on Route 9, I believe it was Route 9, saying, "Bring 'em home." It was my favorite song of his, by the way. You know, if you love your Uncle Sam, it was a fabulous song. And he would be out there. If it was one person, it would be Pete. When he had something, you know, when the judge sentenced him, he went before HUAC, and he and they said name
names. The
House
on American Activities Committee, right?
Yeah. I'm so sorry, John. Yeah, that's right. And they asked him, to name names, and he wouldn't do it. And some people did do it. Believe me, they did it. And some of his closest friends. There was a big problem with Burl Ives at one point. I asked him once, I said, how did you do with Burl Ives? Did you ever make peace? He said, well, one day we were at a concert together, and I saw him there and we embraced, he said. This is years later. And he said, and you know what? He forgave me my trespasses and I forgave him his. That's the kind of man.
To everything, turn. Alan Chartok, well, we got to go, but sure. Thanks so much for all those memories. I know you got hours and hours more.
We do. And John, thanks for asking. Appreciate it.
Alan Chartok, president and CEO for WAMC Northeast Public Radio, remembering Pete Seeger. Party of 100 million people to watch the Denver Broncos take on the Seattle Seahawks in Super Bowl 48, a chilly outdoor game here in the New York area. It's legacy man Peyton Manning versus the Legion of Boom, the Seattle Seahawks defense. And if there is a sizable group out there concerned about the brutality of football and turning off the game on Sunday, it probably won't show up in those ratings. Tomorrow we'll begin announcing the finalists in our soup or bowl competition to warm the tummies of the chilly folks at the game on Sunday and a chance to share some great recipes from so many of you. But with an ample appetite for competition, game time, food, and sports talk, James Brown of the NFL Today on CBS and Inside the NFL on Showtime took some time out to reflect on this season and what has been a real turning point for the NFL, a new concern about the health of its players, a landmark legal settlement to address long-term brain injury. In 2013, JB says the NFL brass found themselves in the red zone on the health issue.
I would like to believe, and I'm sure there are, a number of people who are associated with the league office who are genuinely concerned about the health of the players and want to do things the right way. But I'm also not so naive as to think that there are many who are looking strictly at the bottom dollar, if you will. The recent rejection by Judge Ann Doty of the concussion lawsuit settlement, she rejected that. She wanted to see how the numbers were arrived at because it's her belief that this may not be enough to cover. So I'm all for that because at the end of the day, John, what needs to prevail is what is right. And those who may be thinking only in terms of numbers, and hey, it was a good business decision for the league to settle this without any culpability in terms of admitting whether they knew or didn't know about the issues associated with long-term effects, dementia, and the like, irrespective of all of that, do what's right.
You know, and that's the clash, because on the one hand, you know, you can care for players. You can help them and support them when post-career, you know, they're having medical problems. That's one thing. But it's not to be confused with covering your rear end in terms of liability. One does not substitute for the other. You're either going to care for the players or you're going to care for your sort of liability question. Do you think the NFL has figured out which is which right now?
I believe, irrespective of what others may think, that Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, really has a good heart. He absolutely unequivocally is trying to change the tone and tenor of the game, that it is going to have to look a lot different, those are my words, a lot different than what it has looked like in terms of the rules and player safety on the field. I've admired the way that Roger Goodell, as a CEO, if you will, has gone about surrounding himself with people who are highly regarded in the league, ex-coaches and players, people who run these organizations who truly have the best interests at heart, and to make certain there's a healthy balance there. And I believe that firmly.
Do you think a player who, say, a defensive lineman or an offensive lineman who gives three solid years and then is injured and can't go back, and, you know, how much did they get paid for those 3 years? But for those 3 years, they may have enabled a Peyton Manning to make those unbelievable downfield passes that were so dramatic, that were spectacular entertainment. Should that player be kind of set up for life? Should they have a retirement that basically is going to compensate them for the potential loss of physical ability because of the punishment of this game?
From my perspective, that would speak to having the best and most comprehensive workers' compensation plan in place, health coverage, et cetera. Can that be improved? Unquestionably. If you understand anything about football, the game really is, and it starts in the trenches with the offensive line and the defensive lines. And those guys for 60, 62, 65 plays a game, snaps a game, if you will, in the vernacular. They are going head-to-head, toe-to-toe. There are collisions each and every time out. The human body can only handle and stand so much. So should they have the best plans in place? Absolutely.
As a broadcaster, you see this. I mean, you work with some of the finest NFL legends who are there behind the mic, Boomer Esiason, of course, with you. When the cameras stop rolling, do you notice in the speed or maybe lack of speed at which someone gets out of the chair or walks over to the water fountain, just the cost that these players have paid to play this game?
Anecdotally, John, I 1 year was blessed to host the Hall of Fame dinner in Canton, Ohio. And as I was introducing the 50-plus players who were there for the dinner that evening, it struck me how many came in with limps, or some with many with canes, and even some with walkers. So later in life, there's no question the toll that the game takes on one's body is palpable, and it's evident as one gets older. I don't see that as an issue with the guys with whom I'm working right now, even on Inside the NFL with Phil Simms, the former New York Giants quarterback and Super Bowl MVP, and Chris Collinsworth, who took over for John Madden. These guys play the game as well, too, but almost to a man, many of them have had multiple surgeries already, and some have put off surgeries that they need to have because they're just trying to cope with it right now. But as one gets older, those things do start to surface, yes.
What's the NFL's path forward, do you think? I mean, you've talked about how these wake-up calls have been heeded, at least as far as you can tell. But did you ever imagine that you would live to see a day where there are actually credible voices in the media for one reason or another calling for boycotting the game on Sunday because of the issues of gladiatorial sort of violence on the field? This is not something you would have even imagined a decade ago.
Give me an example, John.
Well, there's an essayist who says, I won't be watching this Sunday. His name's Steve Almond. But if I'm completely honest about my misgivings, it's not just that the NFL is a negligent employer. It's how our worship of the game has blinded us to its pathologies. Now, that would have been a completely fringe view 10 years ago, but, you know, it's getting some traction.
And to me, that essay, if you will, sounds like one that would have played well even back in the Roman gladiator times as well. Look, the love of the game, the love of combatants out there on the playing field has been there since time immemorial. I think to the degree that we can, and I'm seeing definitive moves afoot. I've been around the game for a long time in a professional capacity as a broadcaster since 1986. So I do understand, and I've seen some definitive moves in the right direction. Have there been things that have occurred in the past that would not fly and should not have flown? Absolutely. But I'm seeing definitive changes now to bring that kind of sensitivity and thoughtfulness to the human condition, if you will, to the players. And look, that's what the NFL Players Association is there for as well, to make certain that it's advocating aggressively and passionately on behalf of the players to ensure that the workplace environment is one that is humane. And I'm seeing a lot more progress over the last 10, 20 years than certainly even before about the things that I've read and more importantly have talked to those players who played back in those earlier eras.
James Brown, JB, it's great to talk to you.
Hey, John, look forward to doing it again. Thank you so much for having me.
James Brown, longtime NFL broadcaster. He's the host of the NFL Today on CBS and Inside the NFL on Showtime. If you want to hear James Brown's thoughts on the Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman after his outburst on the air after his team secured a place in the Super Bowl, you can visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Some very insightful comments there from James Brown and why he's disappointed in those in the media who have labeled Richard Sherman a thug. Going to leave you this hour just as we started, something great from the great Pete Seeger. 94 long years, live well. Thank you for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.